5? I don't know. Speaking of economists, Doug Henwood has posted on Facebook that he thinks that he likes a column by David Brooks. David Brooks has come out against solitary confinement. Archipelago of Pain is the title of his article. So I have to read it because most of the time I can't finish Dave Brooks' article because they're so absurd. There's actually a thing that you can look up, the 10 worst things about David Brooks. A lot of critique. Anyway, a lot of critique could be had all around. Hopefully it'll be critically constructive critique in my case. It's 11 o'clock, WEFT, Champaign, Urbana, listener-sponsored and volunteer-operated radio. Thanks for your attention, and thanks for your support of WEFT. It's time for the Labor Hour.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listener-supported community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, broadcasting from downtown Champaign at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bob with some of our underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, give them a call at 217-328-2295. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour.
Okay, thank you, Bob. We're going to be having a guest call in at half past the hour, Dr. Jack Rasmus, author. Oh, man, this guy's got quite a bio, but he's an economist, an author. He's been a past contract negotiator and organizer for various international unions, and he's also one of the members of the Green Party Shadow Cabinet. So he's going to be calling and talking about a few topics, but he's going to focus on his recent interview with the Boeing workers out in Washington State, who, well, we covered this on the World Labor Hour back when it happened, about how their international union, the International Association of Machinists, actually worked against the interests of the workers at the local in favor of Boeing, who one of them had taken a concessionary contract, and this was right after Boeing received the largest corporate subsidies ever from the state of Washington. So it's quite a story, and he's going to be talking a little bit about that as well, so stay tuned. So until then, we got a few news stories, starting with Bob.
Yeah, kind of continuing there with the state of Washington. There seems to be a lot of interesting stuff happening out there. They have the highest minimum wage state, Washington, and yet they seem to be beating the U.S. job growth here. It says Washington residents voted in 1998 to raise the state's minimum wage and link it to the cost of living, and opponents warned the measure would be a job killer. The prediction hasn't been borne out. In the 15 years that followed, the state's minimum wage has climbed to $9.32, the highest in the country. Meanwhile, job growth has continued at an average of 0.8% annual pace, and that happens to be 0.3 percentage points above the national average. Payrolls at Washington's restaurants and bars, portrayed as particularly vulnerable to higher wage costs, expanded by 21%, and poverty there has trailed the U.S. level for at least 7 years. And now they say the debate is replaying on a national scale as Democrats led by President Barack Obama push for an increase in the $7.25 an hour minimum federal wage. And once again, opponents argue that a raise would hurt those it's intended to help by axing jobs for the lowest skilled. Even if that proves true, Washington's example shows that any such effects aren't big enough to throw its economy and labor market off the tracks. So it says here, raising the U.S. minimum wage to $10.10 in three steps, as Obama proposes, would reduce employment nationally by about 500,000 workers, or about 0.3%, according to a Congressional Budget Office report just published a couple weeks ago, February 18th. At the same time, the increase would lift 900,000 people out of poverty and add $31 billion of earnings to low-wage Americans, you know. So it goes on to say that most of these companies end up just raising their rates a little bit to their customers, you know. As of January 21st, or as of January, 21 states in the District of Columbia had higher minimum wages than the federal floor. Cities including San Francisco and Santa Fe, New Mexico, require even higher hourly wage earnings than the proposed federal level at $10.74 an hour and $10.66 an hour, respectively. So those are at, you know, just individual cities. Now, so a lot of people are pushing for the $15 an hour minimum, you know. And it says here, Washington's relatively benign experience with the higher minimum wage has encouraged some communities in the state to push for even more. We talked about it recently. SeaTac, Washington, which is a Seattle suburb where the major employer is the region's international airport, voted in November to raise the hourly minimum wage by more than 60% to $15 an hour for the 6,300 people who work at the airport, hotels, and nearby businesses. It says companies, including the parking lot operator Masterpark, had said the higher pay might lead to job losses. Since its passed, 140 Masterpark employees have received raises, and the company hasn't cut jobs because that might compromise service. So this doesn't seem to be the play out sometimes, as they seem to say. It also says Seattle's mayor, Ed Murray, Democrat elected in November, is following SeaTac's lead as he also promotes raising the city's minimum wage to $15 an hour. And a task force of business and labor representatives advised by academics from the University of California at Berkeley and Washington and Seattle is meeting monthly and hopes to produce a proposal in April. So what he says there is, he says, we can't rebuild this economy if it's just people who buy 94-foot yachts and play in the derivatives. You build an economy when a middle class is buying microwaves or flat-screen TVs or the next set of clothes for their kids.
Yeah, Henry Ford realized that back in the 19-teens, you know. And, you know, that's the thing, is they always try to say that, okay, you increase wages, that it's going to increase costs. Well, you know, of course, they completely ignore profit margins. I mean, why can't you – in fact, you look at what the average corporate America, their profit levels over the last 30 years and CEO pay, I mean, it would be very conceivable to be able to raise wages, keep prices the same, and just cut some of the CEO salaries and a little bit of the profit margin. But, of course, they never want to discuss that.
Which is in this story, one possible explanation is that businesses have plenty of ways besides job cuts to absorb the costs of a minimum wage increase. And they go on to say that those items are price increases, reductions in profits, and what they point out here, savings from lower turnover
Employees
yes. can help soak up the shock. So, yeah.
Good point on the turnover.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, now the story out of Chicago. The Chicago Federation of Labor, which represents more than 320 affiliated unions and more than 500,000 union members in Chicago and Cook County, voted to support boycotting Chicago teachers on March 4th. It says here that a resolution was put on the agenda to support the Chicago Teachers Union members who are boycotting the Illinois Standards Achievement Test, the ISATs. Robert Ryder, Secretary Treasurer of the Chicago Federation of Labor, introduced the resolution in a short explanation to the delegates by a Chicago Teachers Union Local 1 representative of the reasons why the teachers were boycotting the test. And it was made clear that the tests were irrelevant to student achievement and being phased out anyway next year. Even more persuasive was the fact that these types of outdated tests take up to 2 weeks of instructional time away from the children in the Chicago public schools, which are a waste of money and resources. Resolution passed unanimously by the delegates. It was resolved that the Chicago Federation of Labor support the right of the teachers to exercise their First Amendment rights to boycott the standardized tests.
Interesting. Today, I guess, is International Women's Day, and I came across a story here out of the Statesman who says we mustn't forget the revolutionary roots of International Women's Day. It talks about International Women's Day as a day, according to the UN, to reflect on the progress made and to celebrate acts by ordinary women. And it talks about those who brought the day into being, that they forged International Women's Day in the midst of fire, bloody strikes, starving workers, and revolution. Louise Zeitz and Clara Zetkin were the first to come up with the idea. They were inspired by growing numbers of female activists. In 1910, they proposed to the Second Socialist International, the organization of a day worldwide dedicated to promoting women's rights. And against the backdrop of ambivalence from male unions, women began organizing for decades, or had been organizing for decades. Cap makers, match girls, and laundresses had all picketed at the turn of the 20th century. And as Zetkin and Zeitz made their proposal, the uprising of 20,000 was drawing worldwide attention. A bloody strike by New York's garment workers was led by Clara Lemlich, a 23-year-old Ukrainian Jewish immigrant who rallied tens of thousands of women to the picket lines, even after thugs hired by her employers broke her ribs.
Oh, man.
So the first International Women's Day took place on the 19th of March, 1911. Over a million women across Europe took to the streets calling for equal rights. Jubilation at the day's success was short-lived, however. Less than a week later, fire ripped through the sweatshop where Clara Lemlich worked, killing 146 workers who'd been locked inside by their employers, the Triangle Shirtwaist incident, okay. You know. Mm-hmm. Lemlich lost a cousin to the flames, collapsing in hysterics when she was unable to find her body. The tragedy, still one of the worst industrial disasters in U.S. history, brought universal condemnation, focusing future International Women's Day campaigning fiercely on workers' rights. And International Women's Day was just solidifying into a proudly left-wing tradition when the First World War broke out in 1914 and socialist organization collapsed in chaos. In 1917, however, International Women's Day took on significance again when a group of Russian women triggered one of the most monumental events of the 20th century. Marching in St. Petersburg, they were unexpectedly joined by workers from surrounding factories, supporting their calls for bread and peace. Within hours, a full-scale revolution had broken out. Tsar Nicholas abdicated. A new government was set up, and 6 months later, the Bolsheviks took control.
This is fascinating. I had no idea this history on international
Me neither.
Women's.
Till this morning, I looked it up. It says here, sweatshops still exist across the world, as do trafficking, slavery, horrendous working conditions, and unsanitary living conditions. On our own doorstep, women are bearing the brunt of the cuts. Single mothers, poor teenagers in inner cities, ordinary working women who struggle to put food on the table. What we debate on Twitter, on our much fought over platforms in the press, pink toys, boobs in newspapers, and women on banknotes, none of which is unimportant, but which have all risen to the top of the debate because of our reluctance to deal with anything filthier.
Mm-hmm.
Says International Women's Day, and perhaps feminism in general, now veers dangerously close to paint-by-numbers protest.
So, I like that phrase. That's good.
Yeah. So it says here, when Clara Lemlich died, age 96, she was organizing her care workers into a union. International Women's Day shouldn't just be about the poor in order to respect women like her, but because of what she knew to the last, that to make society better for everyone, you have to start with the ones who have it worst.
Good point.
On the 8th of March, that's what we should be reflecting upon. And they go on to say, remember the Rana Plaza in Bangladesh, 1,138 mm-hmm. workers. About a year ago, April 24th of 2013, to this day, Walmart and 19 other companies still haven't contributed to the fund to their families. Phnom Penh, there was 500,000 garment workers, 90% of which are women. Their demand is simply for $160 a month.
Wow.
There were 20-some workers in jail. They trained 2,000 riot police this week to deal with the Union International Women's Day Forum that they were going to have at Freedom Park today. So so they're training 2,000 riot police to deal with a bunch of women and union workers.
Yes, I'll tell you, the more things change, the more they stay the same, unfortunately. We did make a bunch of progress, in the early part of the 20th century, middle part of the 20th century, and then it's like we've made a couple steps back here,
Yes.
Well, I remember when we covered that story about the Bangladesh garment workers, mostly women that were killed in that building collapse, the first thought that came to my mind and yours and some other people was immediately the 1911 Triangle Shirt Factory fire.
Right.
Here we are, 100 years later.
Right. Same thing's going on.
Yes,
just
indeed.
A little further away,
Man, that was a great story, Bob. That was an excellent story and made me give a whole new appreciation for, International Women's Day.
Yeah, and they said because of some of the things that happened with the Russian Revolution back there, during the McCarthy era, the United States really tried to put a damper on International Women's Day, which makes sense. We don't celebrate Labor Day here like they do in other parts of
May
the country
1st.
Either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
for some reason, we seem to think we have a better idea.
Okay, here's a local story. One of the newest mail pieces from Sam Rosenberg, the Democratic candidate for the Illinois House in the 103rd District, gets an award for political chutzpah. It's paid for by the Democratic Majority Political Action Committee chaired by House Speaker Michael Madigan. But the mailer, one of about a half a dozen sent out in the last week on behalf of Rosenberg, hits, quote-unquote, politicians who failed to properly fund the state's pensions and promises that Rosenberg, quote, will oppose any legislation that unfairly strips workers of their retirements. On both counts, that's Michael Madigan. Madigan has been in Springfield longer than any other state legislator, elected in 1970, has served as Speaker for all but two of the last 31 years, and was running the House during the famous quote-unquote pension holiday of 2005, when Governor Rob Blagojevich persuaded lawmakers to cut pension funding by $2.3 billion over 2 years. Madigan voted for it, as did State Representative Naomi Jacobson of Urbana, who has also endorsed Rosenberg. Also, as said in the mail piece, is that it was Madigan who last year pushed through the legislature a bill vehemently opposed by public employee and retiree groups that slows the increase of cost of living raises. The bill would not have passed without me, Madigan boasted in a statement after controversial Senate Bill 1 was signed into law. The promise of a secure retirement was made to hundreds of thousands of workers in Illinois, says Rosenberg's anti-Madigan mailer paid for by Madigan. The mailer never says that Madigan, as head of the Democratic Majority Committee, had a major role in breaking that promise. Meanwhile, Rosenberg's campaign continues to benefit from Madigan-related groups. Of the $109,149 the campaign has raised so far, Rosenberg campaign, including loans and in-kind contributions, more than $42,000 of that has come from either the Democratic Majority or the Friends of Michael J. Madigan. Rosenberg's primary opponent, Urbana City Council member Carol Ammons, has raised a fraction of Rosenberg's sum at $11,229.
Wow.
You know, Bob, this is a really...
10%, huh?
Yes. This is a really interesting race in a lot of factors. I mean, I have never, you know, in my entire life living in this community and being interested in politics, frankly, since I was, believe it or not, 6 years old, have ever seen in a Democratic primary so much time and money being exerted by the state Democratic Party to try to defeat a Democratic primary candidate. Unbelievable. On top of that, I got a call from a union electrician friend of mine the other day, and he said that he got a letter in the mail from his international president in Washington, D.C., Ed Hill, the head of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, telling the IBEW members in the 103rd District here in Champaign-Urbana to vote for Sam Rosenberg.
Really? This is from the international?
Yeah, in Washington, D.C. I mean, that is phenomenal.
Yes.
Considering that we're just a small little local state rep race in the middle of central Illinois. Mm-hmm. You know, we're pretty insignificant to the Washington, D.C. beltway. But however, somebody, you know, pulled some strings here. I mean, I could pretty much give you a flow chart on my theory on how that happened, but nevertheless, it's unprecedented. I mean, it's really amazing. I mean, they seem to be really frightened of the prospect of Carol Ammons getting elected to state rep, and I wonder why. I mean, that really begs the question here, you know?
Well, I don't know. You know?
Yeah, well, I'm not expecting an answer.
The roots of International Women Day started in Revolution, right?
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe we'll leave it at that. That's a good little food for thought there, Bob. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break, and then we'll be right back. Stay tuned. We're going to be having Dr. Jack Rasmus calling in at half past the hour. You're listening to the World Illinois World Labor Hour on WFT, listener-supported community radio station in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned. Okay, that was Copper Kettle. That was Copper Kelly. Since we're coming up to St. Patrick's Day, I thought I'd sneak a little Irish music in there. Anyway, we got a few public service announcements here. Bob?
Yeah, WEFT 90.1 FM invites you to its Spring Jazz Jam benefit at the Iron Post. That's at the corner of Race and Elm Street in downtown Urbana. It's going to start next Sunday at 6 p.m., Sunday, March 16th. And you can enjoy jazz music by Chip Stevens and Larry Gray, Brad Wheeler and the Reginald Chapman Group. And all this while supporting community radio in East Central Illinois. Admission is only $10, with all of the proceeds going to not-for-profit radio station WEFT in Champaign. So come on out and join us. It'll be a great evening, a great jazz here with three excellent groups. And as it says, all the proceeds go to help us stay on the air.
Okay, well, that's definitely a worthy cause, because you're not going to hear programs like this on corporate radio stations or the music genres that we offer here at WFT. So, yes, anything to help us keep on the air is a good cause, of course. Okay, another sports show with host fellow worker Neil Parthen is on from 2 to 3 p.m. today on WRFU 104.5 and broadcast on Wednesday evenings on Comcast Channel 6, Urbana Public Television. And on Sundays, there from 4 to 5 p.m. is Labor's Worldview TV. And tune into that. And you can see an interview that I did with Carol Ammons, which will be running this Sunday and the following Sunday. And then tune in here on WEFT on Wednesdays from 6 to 8 for the Midwatch with host Reasonable Man Stan. So lots of good public affairs program here at WFT. And, you know, that's reason why it's really important to try to keep us on the air and try to spread community radio to other parts of the country if possible. So, Bob, yeah. Do you have some more underwriting announcements for our caller?
Yeah, sure do. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees and the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob. So our guest, Dr. Jack Rasmus, should be calling in here any minute. So I'll just give you a little rundown, kind of a little bit of his biography. Dr. Jack Rasmus, author of various books, The Epic Recession, also Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few, and The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush. A journalist writing on economic, political, and labor issues for various magazines, including Z Magazine and In These Times. And for the more than a decade, a contract negotiator and organizer for several labor unions. He's also a member of the Green Party shadow cabinet. And Jack's going to be talking about working people in the global economy and also his recent interview with rank-and-file Boeing workers in Seattle who were sold out by their national union in a contract vote. So, yeah, he'll be calling here in a second. But, you know, it's really amazing. You know, this is not the first time this has happened, where you have a situation where a local union somewhere is at odds with their international union, and then the international union actually works with the company against the local workers in the local union. I mean, for a lot of people, you know, this might sound like, you know, this doesn't compute, so to speak. It just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, unfortunately, this is part of corporate unionism.
I got a little bit about just that. It says, outrage at Boeing spurs reformers' bid for top spots in the machinist union. Story from a couple weeks ago in February, but it says, for the first time in more than 50 years, the machinist union, IAM, will hold a contested election for top officers. The vote was ordered by the Department of Labor after member Karen Osanchian protested violation in the union's 2013 uncontested election. And this is due to opposition slate because of the whole deal at Boeing out there. So.
Okay. Hello, WFT. You're on the air.
Yes, this is Dr. Jack Rasmus.
Well, Dr. Rasmus, thank you for agreeing to call into the World Labor Hour. And anyway, yes, we just read a little bit about your bio shortly before you called in. And, you know, it's amazing. I had no idea you'd done so much in your years. I mean, it's just quite frankly, it's quite incredible. You know, we kind of wanted you to call in today to talk a little bit about, well, we definitely want you to get to the whole thing about your recent interview with the Machinist Union workers out in Washington. But I'd like you to kind of maybe talk about a little about, you know, working people in the global economy, because this is, seems like it's been a focus of yours for quite some time.
Yes, well, my view is that union labor, and let's talk about union labor, and then we can talk about labor in general, focusing primarily on the U.S. that I know most about, having been a union officer myself for a number of years at the local level and a business agent and an organizer for several different unions. My view is, basic view, is that labor is that union labor is at a strategic impasse. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean, if you look at the strategies labor has, AFL-CIO changed to win independence, have employed for the last 20 years, they are not only not delivering, they are not even protecting against rollbacks. So the strategies aren't really working. Now, what strategies am I talking about? Organizing strategy, for one. While there are a few exceptions of some minimal successes, nurses and so forth, most unions are in decline in terms of membership. Collective bargaining is not only not producing gains, it's resulting in inability to protect the gains of the past. So organizing strategy and bargaining strategy, what I would call together industrial strategy, is at an impasse. Doesn't seem to be any solutions being employed out there. That doesn't mean workers don't want unions. They do, overwhelmingly. There's all kinds of evidence, studies and forecasts and so forth, surveys that show workers want unions more than ever before. But for some reason, the AFL-CIO change to win can't connect with them. Can't seem to bring them into the fold. You know, what are the reasons for that? Is it just employer opposition, or is there something internally wrong with the approach that's being used?
Now, you mentioned you said for about the last 20 years, so you're going back to about the mid-90s when you...
Well, you know, you could go back a little earlier. I guess the real shift, in my view, begins in the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
Okay, that's the real shift. In my my first book, The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive, from Reagan to Bush,
mm-hmm.
Published in 2006. That was an attempt to do a couple things. Show the policies that have been employed both at the industrial level, company level, and at the political level that have been responsible for rolling back labor and, of course, rolling back wage gains. There's a whole number of policies you can identify, and to put a number on that, how much has been shifted from the working class in this country to their employers and their stockholders and beneficiaries. And in 2005, when I wrote that book, I documented it, showed a series of policies that at that time were shifting $1 trillion a year. That was at that time. So it's even more now being shifted as a result of, conscious policies. Which brings us to the second area. The political strategy of labor, I think, is totally bankrupt. That strategy, of course, is throw money as much as you can and help in kind organizers to the Democratic Party and help get them elected, and then they will turn around and give us a few crumbs. Well, that strategy, if you look at it, is also totally bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't produced. In fact, last two national elections, presidential elections, organized labor has spent somewhere around $400 million each, and not counting the in-kind, in other words, free support work on the street, getting out to vote, all that stuff. And it's produced nothing. We we got nothing out of what was supposed to be an Obama-friendly, labor-friendly administration now for 6 years. Nothing from them. They wouldn't even bring the Free Choice Act to out of committee.
Mm-hmm.
If you look all across the board, all labor's interest totally rejected here. They got a few token appointments to the NLRB, which are being blocked, of course. You can argue that's the Republicans, and I guess that has been a factor here. Don't get me wrong, in terms of Obama's failure to deliver, but I believe he could have done an awful lot more independently, executive actions and so forth, and just didn't do it. So they're taking labor's money, but they're not giving anything in return, more so than ever before. Something's wrong with that strategy, you know? I mean, organizations and companies and so forth, if they looked at the last 20, 30 years and saw their leadership doing what they're doing in labor, they would throw them out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Of course, that's not really happened. And I'm not arguing that the solution is just simply to change leadership. Don't get me wrong. I think it's deeper than that, much deeper. But there is a political strategic impasse. There is an industrial organizing and bargaining impasse, a strategic impasse. And there is also, I think, an impasse in how labor relates to community groups and organizations. A lot of tokenism, a lot of talk,
mm-hmm.
and maybe some relationships with, very tame and acceptable political organizations, but no real, and there are exceptions to the rule. Don't get me wrong. I mean, look at the Chicago teachers. You know, they went out to the community and they built an alliance with the community. You got to commend them for that, but that's the exception to the rule.
Yes.
You don't see that anywhere else.
Indeed.
They replicate it.
That's right, and I'm glad you brought that up because that was going to lead me to my next point, was that before the Chicago Teachers Union were able to do that, they had to get rid of their old leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, that's because the old leadership is so tied to the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party does not want labor to really ally at the grassroots
mm-hmm.
with these community organizations. The party wants to manipulate these organizations and manipulate labor. So, you know, the leadership does what the Democratic Party pretty much wants when it comes to something at the grassroots level. Occasionally, though, you get an eruption like Chicago, or mm-hmm. you get an eruption like the demonstrations in Wisconsin to protect bargaining and their unions there. But then you see the union leadership combining with the Democratic Party leadership and diverting that Wisconsin uprising to a very safe electoral kind of activity.
Which flopped, by the way.
Oh, well, of course. I mean, if you pick a candidate you know is going to lose, which is what the Democrats did, the same guy who was defeated by Walker, they run again against Walker, you know, and he comes out and he's sort of lukewarm on collective bargaining and the public unions anyway. So what are you supporting a guy like that for? But that's where the leadership of the unions drove that rank and file upsurge in the direction they drove it to.
Yes. Now, you know, a lot of unions don't have the ability, like the Chicago Teachers Union, to get rid of their leadership. I come out of the Carpenters Union, a very dictatorial union, and there's other unions. And in fact, the National AFL-CIO, I mean, it's structured to where it's almost impossible to get rid of, upper leadership. And so I think this is a very, very good point, which, of course, leads right into what kind of piqued your interest in doing the interview you did with the Boeing workers out in Seattle.
Well, the Boeing was a good example of what I call this bureaucratic political legal web that has grown up in the post-war period, developed in the U.S., where both the government and the leadership, very top leadership in the unions, have this nice cozy relationship where it's very hard to unseat a national leader. In other words, the way it's structured and the votes and the way you've got to organize, it's almost impossible not impossible, but almost in many cases, to unseat these guys at the top. And the government colludes with them. The laws they've developed, you know, Landon Griffin and all this other stuff, court decisions, keep that top leadership in there. And the government, you know, doesn't go after them unless they, you know, they rebel, you know, like Kerry and,
yes,
and the Teamsters. You know, then they'll go after them and change, you know, help get them out of there and get somebody Kapoyan in there. But it's very hard to, you know, grassroots unseat these guys at the top. And that was a good example of what was going on in with Boeing there. And the machinists, and you got to also remember, people aren't aware that perhaps that the way the court decisions have evolved over the years is that local unions don't own their contracts anymore. These contracts are held by the national union. So in a sense, what that means is that if the national union doesn't like what's being negotiated, it can step in and take over the rights to negotiate that contract. In other words, isolate local leaders and say, you don't have authority because this is our contract.
Mm-hmm.
This is the union's contract. This is not the local's contract.
Yeah, it's almost like a franchise model. You know.
Yeah, and you know, it's like, yes, it's a franchise model. It's labor. That's a good question, a good point to make. So, you know, the way I see it, it's very... They made it very hard to have a real democratic uprising and workers take over their own unions. It's not impossible, don't get me wrong. And different unions have different degrees of this national control. But if you really get out of hand and they really want to isolate you, they just say that you can't represent them, the union, anymore. We will do all the negotiating, and you can't even handle grievances with the employer, you know, because it's our contract, it's not your contract, that kind of a thing. So the Boeing workers situation is also interesting because it represents this new increased attack on benefits and pensions. Employers have made up their mind in the last decade. They want to get rid of defined benefit pension plans, and they've almost done it. And they want to get out of the employer health care negotiating business, you know, employer-negotiated health plans with unions. Those two things, defined benefit pensions and employer health plans, were created in the immediate post-World War II period as a kind of a compromise between labor. That was, you know, the social contract thing. It was advantageous to employers. It was made legally advantageous to employers to negotiate those because the employers were able to deduct the costs of health care benefits and contributions and pension contributions from their bottom line. In other words, they were able to get the government, therefore the taxpayer, to pay for it. In other words, they take it off the taxes. Also, it allowed them, as the pension funds grew and health and welfare funds grew, it allowed them to count that as assets on their books, so it looked like the companies were more profitable. And of course, you know, the CEOs get bonuses in that case. So those were two nice plums. I wrote about this all in a long article that's on my website, jackrasmus.com, if people are interested, about a year or two ago, called Concession Bargaining and Historical Perspective, where I maintain that for the first 30 years after World War II, unions were adding not only in terms of magnitude of benefits, wages were increasing and so forth, but adding new areas to collective bargaining, like health and welfare, pension, you know, COLAs and all this kind of thing. That was the first phase, post-war phase. The second phase, beginning with Reagan, was a direct attack on on nominal wages and concession bargaining, two-tiered pay schedules, lump sum payments, all that kind of stuff. That's been going on for quite some time. But now in the last decade, the attack is on what I call the social wage. In other words, contributions that workers give up in lieu of wages to put into their pensions and put into their health and welfare plans. In other words, maintenance of benefits, as it's called. Maintenance of benefits bargaining in the last 10, 15 years has now really collapsed, you might say. And all that money that workers put into their pensions and health and welfare is being taken back by employers in one way or another. And that's the latest concession bargaining phase that we have going on. We know of the attacks on pensions, and you could see it in the Boeing deal. Now the big companies are getting rid of their defined benefit pension plans. And you can see the attack on health and welfare, health negotiations, benefits, contributions, maintenance of benefits with the ACA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ACA is designed by 2018, there will be a 40% excise tax placed on union health care plans. That will pretty much destroy union health care plans by 2018. Employers aren't going to put 40% more overnight into these plans, and workers can't afford to give up 40% more wages. So it's going to be the end of health union health care negotiation plans. Unions know about this, so what did they do? They went to Obama and they said, hey, you got to change this. Obama says, go away.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the end is coming for union negotiated health care plans. Everyone's going to have to go out and on these exchanges by their own. Employers will say, okay, we'll give you what we've been putting into the plan so far. We're not putting anything more. Washed their hands of it and said, you're on your own with health care. We're not making any more contributions into health care.
You know, it amazes me with that phenomenon you're describing. Why is it that organized labor hasn't been speaking out for a single-payer health care system? I mean, they give lip service to it, but, you know, I'm involved with the Illinois Single Payer Coalition. We can't get any unions involved. I mean, we've tried and tried for over mm-hmm. 2 years now, and none of them will come. Not the CTU, not the UE, none of these unions that are, you know, talk about it in the past. It's amazing to me, frankly, you know.
Well, you shouldn't be too amazing because the policy of the national unions leadership is it's to give lip service, but not really push for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why aren't they out in the streets?
Yes.
They're going to take away your health care plans. They're destroying your defined benefit pension plans. Why aren't they out in the street? Well, because they don't want to embarrass the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democratic Party is telling them, you know, don't stir the pot on this, because if you stir the pot on Medicare for All, I prefer to call it Medicare for All. People can understand
yes.
that, but it's
yes.
a single payer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's imminently reasonable. Medicare for All, one of the most efficiently run health care programs in the world. And if you stir that pot, gee, people will expect more. And that will undermine our attempt to get this ACA, you know, Obamacare thing established. And Obamacare is really privatization.
Yes.
Healthcare. This is what George W. Bush was trying to achieve with health savings accounts. It couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama is, you know, delivering the goods on this. And, you know, the next thing will be a further attack on Social Security, but they're biding their time on that until 2016.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the Boeing workers, I just heard that there's somebody from that local that's going to actually run for international president.
No, the president is a guy from back east, a staffer. You see, part of this.
Ah, yes, a Hollis coup again. Okay.
Yeah, this whole system that they've got, it makes it almost impossible for rank and filers in a local to run. You got to be a staffer, someone who is, you know, part of the team on the top, sitting on everybody, who then breaks. In other words, it's a dispute between. Between the leadership,
mm-hmm.
and you always end up, you know, supporting one rather than the other, lesser evil. And, you know, they say a lot like typical politicians, and they get in there, and things don't really change that much. Because if they tried to change, the government and the other unions, you know, would ostracize and mm-hmm. isolate them. So even though they come in and they really want to do something about it, you know, someone from the staffers, you know, they eventually bend to the status quo.
Yeah, otherwise I'll end up like Kerry from the Teamsters, who did rock the boat, won the UPS strike, and then started protests down on the U.S.-Mexican border.
Or the fellow there on the West Coast, I forget his name, with the hospital workers.
Oh, yes.
In San Francisco. Gee, I should remember his name, but, you know.
Roselli, I think his name is?
Yeah, Roselli. Mm-hmm. You know, both the union and the government, in collusion, isolate the guy and put him on the outs, and you know, it's a strategy to isolate and squeeze and disappear. And you know, he had a huge base.
Yes.
In the California Hospital Workers Union, huge SEIU, huge base. But even he couldn't pull it off.
Yeah, you know, it begs the question though: why are these labor unions doing this? I mean, labor leaders. I mean, is there some kind of like revolving door, like there is with the Pentagon, the defense industry, and the Washington politicians?
I wouldn't say there's a revolving door. you know, these guys, when they leave their top union leadership positions, they don't usually take government positions. And
we've seen like
government don't go in. I mean, you got a revolving door there with the NLRB.
Okay.
And their lawyers. You know, they if you want to be a big corporate lawyer, you go to the NLRB and a couple of years, learn some labor law and everything, and then you get hired by a big corporation. So there definitely is revolving doors there, but not in the union level. But, you know, that doesn't answer your question. Why do they do this?
Yes.
Well, one reason why they do this is they believe that they can get a few crumbs to deliver for their members from the political parties, Democratic Party. But the crumbs are fewer and smaller, of course, as time goes by. You know, they're very comfortable up there. You know, they're not multimillionaires, but they're living very nicely. You know, hundreds of thousands of dollars pay and benefits and so forth. And the government looks the other way, you know, when there's things going on, except when it gets very crude, violation. You know, they would much rather, you know, go to dinner at the White House or have an open door to one of the president's advisors than to do the hard work of organizing and fighting on, you know, at the grassroots level with their members. That's very risky. And when you got to turn the rank and file out to fight, well, then natural leaders arise from the rank and file that may challenge them.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's the number one thing they don't want. They want to stay in that position, comfortable, and see what they can deliver politically, and not turn the ranks loose, because you turn the ranks loose, that's risky in terms of your own political career.
I see. Okay, well, Dr. Rasmus, I know you got another interview to do here, so we're going to, I guess we should let you go, but thank you so much for calling in, and, you know, we'd love to maybe do a follow-up with you here down the road sometime.
I'd love to do that. We really need to talk in labor. We need to talk about this strategic impasse. What's not working in terms of political strategy, industrial strategy, labor-community relations strategy, which we haven't talked about here? Why is it none of that is working anymore? We need a total revamp of our strategic orientation, and we need some kind of new structure at the local grassroots level, not this little stovepipe central labor councils, you know, isolated from other unions, and really all they do is what I call cope, hope, and dope programs. And really, a new structure that would unite community organizations with labor organizations in a new way from the grassroots level. Anyway, I have some ideas there. We can talk about that in the future.
Great. Okay, so thank you for calling in.
Okay, my pleasure. Bye.
Down in the darkness, down at the breaker, close on the midnight hour. Steadily working, quietly leaving, trailing a thin line of powder. The little Schuylkill Valley town is all lit up tonight by flames that lick like tongues from the breaker fire. The tight-lipped coal and iron police
won't get much sleep tonight, looking for the sons of Molly Maguire. Out in the tavern, banded together, strong men are hiding their sorrow. Over at Pottstown, they're at the prison, 10 men are hanging tomorrow. I only tried to organize the men I worked among, but I'm hanging in the morning.
Okay, we're back. This is the World Labor Hour on WFT Listener Community Radio in Champaign, Illinois. That was Cy Khan with a song about the Molly Maguires. And anyway, you listened to earlier Dr. Jack Rasmus, who's an economist, past labor organizer, contract negotiator, and member of the Green Party's shadow cabinet, calling in. And, you know, we just scratched the surface with him, and we definitely got to get him back on and get more in depth in some of these other topics.
A lot of interesting ideas he had there.
Yes, indeed. And remember, this guy was an insider. I mean, so for, you know, for him to say these things is not only, you know, frank honesty, but he knows what he's talking about, you know.
I got a question for you. What is the Green Party shadow cabinet?
Oh, well, what it is basically in other countries, when there's sort of a corrupt, illegitimate government, the opposition party creates a shadow cabinet. Basically, they basically appoint their own ministers and everything else, and they basically kind of have meetings.
So is he kind of the head of the Department of Labor and the Green Party?
Actually, the Federal Reserve.
Oh, really?
Department of Commerce. I don't know. I don't know exactly which one, but yeah, because of his economics background and stuff. So, nevertheless, we want to definitely get him back on the air here. So, but anyway, we're just about out of time. And Bob?
I had a comment because we've been putting our shows up on Radio for All for years, you know? Mm-hmm. And you can download them there, and we point to those off of our Facebook page, Illinois World Labor Hour, and on Facebook. But Radio for All was set up by some of the Pacifica people 15 years ago, and since then some of the people have drifted off to New York, and it's left in one guy's hands basically to keep it all going. There's a lot of great programs up there. Paul Muth gets a lot of his stuff from there. WEFT gets about 4 or 5 weekly programs between 5:30 and 6 from their Liberation Radio, TUC Radio. Anyway, they're losing their rack space out in California, and so they may end up having to disband. Hopefully, if they do, they're going to move all of our programs over to archive.org for us, our whole media library. And we've got years, you know, Bill's been putting the shows up there under the different names of this program. But anyway, I would urge listeners to go to Radio for All, and I think there's some monetary appeals going on out there to try and help raise some money to keep the rack space and server space that they need to keep themselves going. But it was set up to share radio broadcast among community radio stations, and there's a lot of, as Bill Gorell has always said, there's a lot of great programming up there to listen to that you won't find anywhere else, you know.
Yeah.
And we always, you know, on and off, I've missed some times over the years, but, you know, some lapses in our programs. But, you know, we're back on a streak here where we've had the last 6 months or so of our programs going up there on a weekly basis. So they're there for you to download. Go to radioforall.net, and that's the number 4. Look up. They're going up now as under the Illinois World Labor Hour. Mm-hmm. I think Bill put them up under the World Labor Hour. So
and
search.
And before that, you go back far enough, that was also the
East Central Illinois
Labor Journal.
Labor Journal, there you go.
Yeah.
So search any of those out and, you know, see what Radio for All's got going on. They're looking for people that are good programmers, too. If you know PHP scripting and MySQL scripting and stuff, you could maybe really help these people out to do some redirections and stuff. So.
Well, let's hope they, you know, work something out there, because that'd be a real loss. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not just for our past programming, but for all these other, you know, stations and programs, podcasts and everything else over the years, you know.
A lot of interesting and independent information is up there, you know. A lot of Noam Chomsky speeches and a lot of great stuff is up there at Radio for All.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you, Bob, for sharing that with us. Again, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on WFT Listen Support Community.